being an audience for God also means we have to get off center stage. We don't need to be the center of attention and activity all the time. I think it might surprise us to realize how much crazy activity we create in our days just so we can feel important. We wear our busyness like a badge, like our busyness would somehow impress the rest of the world, or impress ourselves. How many of us go to bed with a sense of accomplishment because we checked a lot of things off our task list, or someone told us how great we were, or we helped others? What if we walked off stage altogether and put God there instead? Maybe then we could go to sleep at night, not with a sense of accomplishment, but with a sense of wonder, because all day we had been an attentive audience to the divine play. Brahmacharya reminds us that we aren't embodied in this form to feel dead, but to feel alive. We aren't embodied to snuff out our vitality and passion through excess, but to bring it to full expression. Brahmacharya invites us to be willing to walk around, turned on, to the wonders of life itself. Howard Thurman understood the importance of our passion to the world when he said, "Don't ask yourself what the world needs. Ask yourself what makes you come alive, and then go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive." Questions for exploration. Living with these questions, taking time for reflection, and journaling will give you new insights into your life and the practice of non-excess. For this month, frame your exploration in the following statement by Joseph Campbell. Be true to the purpose and limits of each thing in existence. Behave purely and serve purely the reality of what you are given by making every human function without exception a religious act of sacrifice and worship. Week 1. This week, examine your beliefs, values, habits, and actions around sexuality and sexual activity. Notice what your culture, the media, your faith community, and your family have to say about this topic. Then notice if you act on outside authority or your own beliefs. Week 2. This week, live in non-excess. Eat, work, and sleep to the point of increased energy, and before the lethargy of excess sets in. Ponder the words of Jensai, a Japanese Buddhist monk who said, "The point in life is to know what's enough. For this week, know what is enough and stop there. Practice pleasure without excess." Week 3. This week, notice where you see God and where you don't. Notice the beliefs or judgments that limit your ability to see God and experience God in all things. Then practice letting everything be a relationship with the divine. See the sacred in the ordinary and God in each person you encounter. Ponder the words of Yogi Bhajan. If you can't see God in all, you can't see God at all. See God in all. Week 4. This week, contemplate your own divinity. Are you willing to be sacred? Write down 3 practices that connect you to your passion and your sacredness. For this month, ponder the words of Joseph Campbell and live the sacredness of your life. Aparigraha. Fall deeply in love. Cherish all in your heart. Now open and let go. C.L. Aparigraha, non-possessiveness. I remember when my children were small and I would pick them up at childcare. It didn't matter how much fun they were having with yummy treats to eat, or new toys to explore, or new friends to play with. The minute I entered the room, they dropped everything and ran as fast as they could into my waiting arms. Nothing was more important to them than I was. As they grew older, however, the toys became more and more interesting to them, until at times I would show up and they would totally ignore me. Much like small children, we live in a world with an abundance of treats and toys and friends. They are there for us to enjoy, but never in place of the one who gives these gifts. The jewel of Aparigraha invites us to enjoy life to the fullest, and yet always be able to drop everything and run into the waiting arms of the divine. If we prefer to play with our toys, we have missed the point. Aparigraha, or non-possessiveness, can also be interpreted as non-attachment, non-greed, non-clinging, non-grasping, and non-coveting. We can simply think of it as being able to let go. The sadhu of India recognize how easy it is to become attached to things of this world. Sadhu don the color orange and take vows to renounce all worldly pleasures in favor of the divine. They spend most of their time in the forests, away from any temptations that might become more interesting to them than their companionship with divinity. Although this is an extreme example, it shows one way of staying free of the prison of possessiveness. For those of us who choose to stay immersed in the world, loving and living fully without becoming attached is not an easy thing. When we experience the completeness of being loved, the satisfaction of a superb meal, the acknowledgement of work well done, we can easily want to hold on to these moments and never let them go. It is easy to want the same satisfaction and begin to demand the same fulfillment from these things again and again. But it is the nature of things to change, and by failing to let them change or move on, they begin to disappoint us, and our attempts to hold on begin to make us stale and discontent. What we try to possess possesses us. How do we move through life loving deeply and engaging fully without getting attached? Looking at the inhalation and exhalation of the breath, the timing of trapeze artists, and an ancient practice of catching monkeys can give us glimpses into the ability to let go rather than be attached. The guideline of Aparigraha invites us to let go and to pack lightly for our journey through life, all the while caring deeply and enjoying fully. The breath as teacher. What if we could trust life like we trust the breath? What if we could take in all the nourishment of the moment and then let it go fully, trusting that more nourishment will come? Just like the breath gives us nourishment, so does life in the form of homes, work, relationships, routines that bring ease, beliefs, stances, and images of ourselves. There is nourishment until we get attached to these things, often unconsciously, and then disturb ourselves with expectations, opinions, criticisms, disappointments, all because we forget to trust life, exhale, and let go. Like the breath, when it is held too long, the things that nourish us can become toxic. Aparigraha invites us to practice divine play, experience full intimacy and contact with the moment, and then to let go so the next thing can come. It is how our adhikara, or competency, grows, and how we become more who we are capable of becoming. I have a grand piano that I enjoy playing, but as Yogiraj Achala reminds me, when it is time to eat, I don't carry the piano to the dining room. Why would I want all that weight on my shoulders? And yet, often we do try to carry the piano to the dining room table, so to speak, trying all different ways we can think of to find some kind of permanence, something to hold on to. But the nature of the realm of Aparigraha is impermanence. Everything changes. Nothing stays the same. If we can fall back to the breath and watch the belly rise and fall with each inhalation and exhalation, we can feel the truth of the transience of all things. Hanging in midair. Much like the moment when the breath is completely exhaled, the trapeze artist has a moment when they are suspended in midair. My understanding is that they have to let go of one bar and wait in midair for the next swinging bar to reach them. If they hold on to the current bar or reach for the next bar, their timing will be off and they will fall. Instead, they must let go fully to be ready for the bar swinging towards them, trusting the timing of the swing and not their own effort to reach. I'm not a trapeze artist, but my experience of letting go feels very much like being suspended in mid-air with nothing to hold on to. It is raw, naked, vulnerable, and uncomfortable. I would much prefer to let go when I know for sure what is coming. And when I have let go, I want to somehow stay connected, just in case I want it back. To let go completely feels like a suspension in the void. The practice of non-clinging is as free as swinging from bar to bar effortlessly, in perfect trust and perfect timing. Any kind of holding too long or grasping too far forward in an effort to maintain a sense of security is deadly to our spiritual growth and the natural unfolding of our lives. Let go of the banana. I am fascinated by an ancient process of capturing monkeys in India. Like the breath and the trapeze artist, this process gives us insights into how we stay attached to objects of life and how deadly that can become. In this process of catching monkeys, small cages with narrow bars are made, and a banana is placed inside the cage. The monkeys come along, reach in between the bars, and grab the banana. Then the monkeys begin the impossible task of trying to pull the banana through the bars, and here is the amazing thing. In the moment when the monkey catchers come along, the monkeys are totally free. There is nothing keeping them from running off to safety as they hear danger approach. All they have to do is let go of the banana. Instead, they refuse to release the banana and are easily taken into captivity. Bananas, for us, are anything we expect to give us the same fulfillment the second and third time. When we expect our spouse to make us feel good, like they did the evening before, or when we expect a dinner out to satisfy us, like it did the last time, or when we expect to be appreciated, like we were yesterday. Indeed, any time we want the same feel-good results, we are holding on to the banana. Our expectations keep us captive and often disgruntled. The image of the monkey holding on to the banana is real for those of us captured in our attachments. Indeed, nothing is holding us. We, like the monkeys, are totally free. Instead, we choose to hold on, choosing our attachments and our greed rather than our freedom. To choose freedom, we simply need to let go of the banana. Instead, we create our own prison of captivity. What we hold begins to hold us. As illustrated in the following example, captivity can also be an image of ourself that we insist on holding. What we possess possesses us. When I went through a tough divorce with two small children, I decided then and there that I would never need anyone again. Unconsciously, that decision began to work on me in ways I didn't recognize. I would refuse to ask for help or to accept help when it was offered. I refused to let myself be tired or to rest. I refused to be anything but invincible. I was never going to find myself that vulnerable again. It was decades later that I began to realize the havoc that my attachment to this image of myself was having on my life. I was wearing myself out and wearing out everyone around me. I couldn't stop because if I stopped, I might feel that sense of helplessness again. I was holding on to an image that was in turn holding on to me and keeping me in bondage. The play and spontaneity and fun in my life were becoming almost non-existent. Invincibility was eating all the joy out of my life. Anything we cling to creates a maintenance problem for us. The material items that we hoard, collect, buy because they are on sale or take because they are free, all take up space and demand our attention. Storage boxes and sheds become an easy way to fool ourselves. Subtle attachments come in the form of our images and beliefs about ourselves, about how life should be, about how others should be. These images keep us in bondage to our own learning and growth. Clutter in our physical space blocks our ability to physically move, while clutter in our minds blocks our freedom to expand and have space for the next thing life wants to bring to us. I went through a period of attachment to bean and rice burritos made at our local co-op deli. It didn't matter who was behind the counter. They all knew me, and they knew exactly what I wanted, even the special request for extra filling. On one visit, the server behind the deli began to fix my burrito and made the comment, "You are so boring." Another time, when I was particularly craving my usual, I stopped at the deli in full anticipation of the upcoming indulgence, only to find out they were all out of bean and rice mix for burritos. I was irate and devastated. In that moment, I witnessed the severity of my attachment when I was unwilling to substitute another kind of burrito, instead choosing to have my day ruined. What I was holding on to was holding on to me. Attachments ruin our day when they aren't fulfilled. Attachments make us boring, and attachments keep us blinded to the smorgasbord of new opportunities around us. The word attachment can be traced to a root word that means to nail. Attachments are like nailing ourselves to our need for someone or something to continue to be the same and to always be there for us in the same way. When we nail ourselves to our needs for others, to our feelings, our roles, our agendas, our pleasures, our identities, we become more like rats in a maze than free human beings. Just how many bags are you taking? Recently, my teenage granddaughter and I went on our first overnight retreat adventure together. In my usual organized, prepared style, I started asking her way in advance what we should pack. I held my frustration as the days passed, and the question continued to go unanswered. The day before we were to leave, I said, "Ashley, we have to make plans." "Grandma," she said, "that's the whole point of getting away. Make it easy. Don't take anything, not even plans." Further conversation revealed her packing list: a book, a soccer ball, and a healthy supply of her favorite organic frozen dinners. I found myself stunned at the simplicity of her understanding of retreat time. In my mind, I reviewed the large amounts of packing and preparation that had always burdened my retreat time. Excited at the opportunity, I leaped into this new challenge before me to take nothing with me. I would like to report that my efforts were a success, but alas, the morning we left found us both filling the car with all kinds of last-minute baggage. But the seed had been planted in my mind, and I found myself wondering where else I was missing the point with my planning and packing and hauling. In fact, how many suitcases full of expectations, tasks, plans, resentments, and unforgiven moments was I toting around with me every day? Even airlines know to charge a fine when we pack over the limit, I thought to myself. And yet I wonder how many of us are packing over the limit every morning and wearying ourselves throughout the day with this heavy baggage. What if we woke up every morning and took nothing with us? What if that was the whole point? What if we unpacked our way to God, unpacked our way to freedom, unpacked our way to being? And yet, we seem to put more into our already full suitcases as the day wears on. And we add some disappointments, and maybe a little anger mixed with some frustration to our already heavy load. This craziness we do to ourselves is as silly as if we carried a heavy load of bricks around all day and continued to add more to our pile. "Pack light for the journey," my granddaughter reminded me. "Strip yourself to raw nakedness and vulnerability," the yogis teach us. This is the invitation of non-possessiveness. Are we up to the unpacking? But aren't we supposed to care? Non-attachment does not mean that we don't care, or that we somehow shut ourselves off from the pleasures and joy of life and each other. In fact, non-attachment frees us up to be immersed in appreciation of life and one another. We are asked to let go of the clinging to the thing, not the enjoyment of the thing itself. Letting go of the ownership opens us up to full engagement with what is set before us in the present moment. Life becomes a banquet, and we are free to feast. Like the breath, we are invited to breathe in deeply, enjoying the fullness of the inhalation, and then to let go just as deeply and fully, enjoying the release of the exhale. The fewer attachments we carry with us, the more we are free to enjoy and engage and live every moment before us to the fullest. The more breath we let go of, the more room there is in our body for the fullness of the next inhalation. The more we generously share and give away, the more expansive and light we become. The journey of life is towards freedom. A bird cannot hold its perch and fly. Neither can we grasp anything and be free. Practicing constant generosity and unfailing trust will keep our greed in check and keep us open to life's unfolding. What wants to come to us is so great, and what we hold on to is often so small. Like the trapeze artist, are we willing to be suspended in mid-air in total trust of the timing and of a future that is greater than the one we are holding on to? Questions for exploration. Living with these questions, taking time for reflection, and journaling will give you new insights into your life and the practice of non-possessiveness. For this month, frame your exploration in the following statement by Swami Jananeshwar. Love is what is left when you've let go of all the things you love. Week 1. This week, pay attention to your breath. Let the simple act of inhaling and exhaling teach you about the fullness of breathing in life without the need to hold on to it. Journal your observations and experience. Week 2. This week, look at the physical things you have surrounded yourself with. Do these things make you feel free and light, or do they have a hold on you and make you feel heavy? Remember, what you cling to clings to you. Experience the difference between enjoyment and attachment. Week 3. This week, notice where you impose your expectations on people and things, unconsciously demanding that they give you the usual fulfillment and comfort. How do your expectations keep you limited and often disgruntled? Week 4. Krishna Das makes the observation that in our country, we have a muscle in the mind that we forget is there. He calls it the letting go muscle. Krishna Das says we have developed a strong holding on muscle in the mind, but the letting go muscle is undeveloped. He suggests we get our mind in shape by using this muscle more often, practicing with little things so we are prepared when the bigger things come along. This week, notice when you cling to experiences, emotions, thoughts, habits, and beliefs. Then give your letting go muscle some exercise and begin to let go. For this month, ponder the words of Swami Jananeshwar and live fully in the experience of life without the burden of attachments or the need to possess. Reviewing the Yamas. Not long ago, I was traveling with a friend who had just purchased a new Prius with a GPS, Global Positioning System. I enjoyed the adventure of having a computer talk to me and make sure I was on the right path. I laughed hilariously when my friend continued to drive straight after the computer had given instructions to turn right. The computer immediately responded with, "Drive forward and make an immediate legal U-turn." The Yamas are like our personal GPS. They tell us when we are going in the wrong direction and that we need to make an immediate legal U-turn. They let us know when we are making a negative impact on the world and invite us to turn around and take a step towards harmony instead. The Yamas are not pat, simple answers. They are instructions to move in a certain direction. They require familiarity and daily practice. As our personal GPS, the practice of nonviolence, truthfulness, non-stealing, non-excess, and non-possessiveness turn us from harming ourselves and others to kindness and compassion for self and others, from lies and half-truths to expressing our uniqueness and authenticity, from theft to cultivating new skills and abilities, from greed to appreciation and pleasure without excess, from attachment to intimacy without possession. The Yamas address the fact that we are social creatures, alive on a planet full of other life forms, where we need to learn to live together and share the goods. The Yamas, or restraints, invite us into an adult relationship with the world, where we can see past our own needs into the collective good. In that sense, we can think of them as social disciplines, guiding us into harmony, peace, and right relationship with the world. The Yamas pull us back from needing so much that is external and point us towards the unique expression of our own life. It is here that we feel the excitement and joy of living. As we turn now to the disciplines of the Niyamas, we move our attention from an adult relationship with the world to an adult relationship with ourselves, and from a social focus to an internal focus. As we continue to practice the yamas, we will notice that nonviolence turns us from harming self and others to kindness and compassion for self and others. Truthfulness turns us from lies and half-truths to expressing our uniqueness and authenticity. Non-stealing turns us from theft to cultivating new skills and abilities. Non-excess turns us from greed to appreciation and pleasure without excess. Non-possessiveness turns us from attachment to intimacy without possession. Saucha. It was glistening on the green lady's mantle. Dew so clear and pure. C.L. Saucha. Purity. In the Ragamuffin Gospel, Brennan Manning tells the story of a tense moment in a recovery room. A young female patient is lying in bed. Standing beside her is the surgeon who has just removed a tumor from the young woman's face. Her husband, also in the room, stands at a distance. The patient is looking at herself in a handheld mirror for the first time after the surgery. Staring at the obvious downward-turned corner of one side of her mouth, she asks the surgeon if she will always look lopsided. The surgeon replies a solemn yes, noting that he had to cut a nerve to get the tumor out. In that crucial moment, where the silence betrays a young woman doubting her future physical appeal, the husband acts. He walks over to his wife and tells her that he thinks she looks kind of cute with one side of her mouth turned down. Then he looks at her tenderly, shapes his mouth like hers, matching lips to lips, and kisses her. The jewel of saucha, or purity, carries a twofold meaning. First, saucha invites us to purify our bodies, our thoughts, and our words. As we purify ourselves physically and mentally, we become less cluttered and heavy. Purification brings about a brightness and clarity to our essence. Second, this guideline has a relational quality. No one in that story could have known ahead of time what the outcome of the surgery would be. Yet, in that moment, when the wife doubted her own appeal, the husband was able to be with her purely, and in that purity, support her sense of self and the beauty of their relationship. These two practices of purity are interrelated. As we purify ourselves from the heaviness and clutter of toxins, distractions, and scatteredness, we gain clarity to meet each moment with integrity and freshness. We become more pure in our relationship with each moment. Purity as a cleansing process. The yogis have many practices to purify their bodies. Some may make us react with a "no way, not in my lifetime" attitude, like running string through the nasal passages and out the mouth, or running 32 yards of cotton strip through the digestive system, to name a few. Other purifying processes may be easier for us to engage in, or at least try, like the neti pot. Breath practices and postures are means of purifying the body, as are meditating and following an ethical system, like the yamas and niyamas. We can say what we want about these practices, but one thing is clear. The yogis place a high priority on purification. Why this importance? There is a great energy that lies mostly dormant within each of us. This is the energy of consciousness or awakening. We have all, at times, felt the movement of this energy. Moments when tears silently well in our eyes with the stirring of overwhelming love. Moments when beauty stops us and captures us in wonder. Moments when contentment and well-being ooze from our pores. Moments when the life force pulses through us like electricity, making us vibrant and young. Moments when deep wisdom bathes light on our unknowing. Moments when awareness comes to us in technicolor. These are small tastes of what happens as the energy within us awakens. To practice the guideline of purity is to engage in cleansing processes, both physical and mental, that prepare us for these kinds of experiences all the time. Cleansing strengthens the body and insulates the mind, preparing us for the awakening of the energy within us. Cleansing prepares us for the greatness of our spirit. Cleansing lightens us to experience more of the divine mystery. Taking steps to cleanse and purify ourselves will look different for each of us. Cleansing doesn't have to be earth-shattering or weird to begin to work its magic. It might take the form of increased physical exercise or increased water intake, a day of fasting on fruit and juice, or perhaps a day of cleaning out closets. Maybe we will choose to spend a day purifying our tongue so that we speak nothing of harm or untruth for the entire day. Whatever form purifying takes, it always begins with an intention to lighten the load we are carrying. Where are these loads for you? Maybe your body is carrying poisonous toxins from a poor diet. Maybe your mind is carrying the heavy baggage of victimhood or unforgiveness. Maybe your home and workspace are full of clutter and junk. All of these loads weigh down your body, mind, and spirit. They are real and they are heavy. The guideline of purity invites us to move into ease, to do what it takes to get rid of this heaviness, wherever we find it in our lives. Clean your body, clean your mind, clean your living and workspace. I am one who believes strongly in the power of confession and forgiveness. I have found that some of the things I carry from my past actions need to be confessed, sometimes to a trusted friend, and sometimes to a piece of paper that is then ritually burned. For me, this is a necessary cleansing practice for past errors and judgment and selfishness. In any way that we hold on to past wounds, we injure ourselves and keep ourselves from the ability to be pure with what is current in our lives. Forgiveness of self and other is the most generous gift we can give ourselves. Several years ago, when I did my Kundalini Yoga teacher training under Yogi Bhajan, I had the opportunity to have a private session with him and ask him anything I wanted. At that time, he had given me the spiritual name Amrit Dev, meaning the sweet nectar and wisdom of the guru is within you. The question I chose to ask him was how to live into the fullness of my spiritual name. He began to laugh boisterously, and with a twinkle in his eye and a strong Indian accent, he replied, "Your poop must smell like nectar, and your pee must smell like nectar." He continued to chuckle loudly, and that was the end of my time with him. I had to pick my jaw up off the floor before I could begin to contemplate what he had said. I now understand he was speaking directly to the idea of purity, that I should strive to live in such a way that everything that goes into me and everything that comes out of me is pure. Yogi Bhajan's explanation of my name helped me begin to understand the difference between purification and cleanliness. Recently back from India, I am once again sorting through this difference. I spent almost 2 weeks in an ashram doing purification practices, but it took me 2 hours when I got home to be American clean. In this country, we almost obsess about cleanliness, but pay little attention to purity. Cleanliness is a process of scrubbing the outside of us. It changes our outer appearance. Purification works on our insides and changes our very essence. Although cleanliness is important, Saucha calls us to the inward journey of purification, not the external appearance of cleanliness. Purity as relational. Saucha has a relational quality that asks us not only to seek purity in ourselves, but to seek purity with each moment by allowing it to be as it is. We are asked to be with life, with others, with things, with the day, with work, with the weather, as they are in the moment, not as we wish they were or think they should be or expect them to be. We fail this guideline in any of our attempts to change, judge, criticize, alter, control, manipulate, pretend, be disappointed, or check out. Purity is not our attempt to make something different than it is. Rather, it is to be pure in our relationship with it, as it is in the moment. The difference between being pure with something, rather than trying to make something pure, is a subtle and tricky distinction. We can easily find ourselves in an arrogant position, sitting on our high horse, thinking we are bringing something better to the moment, or perhaps thinking that the moment isn't worth our attention, or maybe even finding ourselves feeling that the moment owes us something. When our thoughts or actions are presumptive like this, we actually stain the purity of the moment. We are not to bring our idea of purity to the moment. We are simply to be with the moment as it is. In order to be pure with something, we are asked to do a lot of subtraction. We have to subtract all of our ideals, illusions, and expectations of what should be and how we want it to be. We even have to drop our image of purity itself to begin to live in the oasis of this jewel. When we find ourselves stuck in a traffic jam, disappointed with our meal, tripping over messes in the house, or dealing with a crabby family member, we are invited to simply be with these times in a pure way, not to judge them as impure moments. My sister-in-law recently returned from visiting her 2-year-old grandson. She was fresh and alive from the experience. All she could talk about was how everything looked new to her because, for a week, she had seen through the curious, delighted eyes of a child. She had gained what the Buddhists call the beginner's mind. Far from being stale, she was gripped with a child's curiosity, which had made her more open, playful, and able to be surprised. She had reclaimed that childhood ability to see things as they really are, as if for the first time. As she stopped imposing her staleness on things, they began to reveal themselves to her in new and wondrous ways. She had become pure with the moment. Perhaps the most difficult place to practice purity is with ourselves. Be honest, how many expectations and illusions do you impose on yourself? I am amazed when I read old journals and find them filled with all the things I will do to improve myself. When I listen to others talk, I know I am not the only one who is hoping to make myself into a picture-perfect version of me. Rather than planning ourselves, what if we practiced unplanning ourselves? Instead of striving to become someone lovable, what if we loved ourselves fiercely as we are? Instead of managing ourselves, what if we loosened the reins? The question remains for each of us to answer. Can you be pure with yourself in each moment? Or, in the words of Anthony DeMello, can you leave yourself alone? Being pure with ourselves means we are not afraid of our thoughts or our feelings, and we do not have to hide anything from ourselves. Matthew Sanford, speaking from the experience of an accident that left him paralyzed from the waist down, says, "I am not afraid of my sadness. My sadness is an incredible gift that allows me to be with people who are suffering without trying to fix them." Matthew invites us to simply and fearlessly be with all the pieces of ourselves. Being pure with all the pieces of ourselves increases our staying power with our own suffering, intimacy, joy, boredom, pain, and anxiety. We become safe with ourselves, and we become a safe place for others. We become a person who can comfortably and compassionately sit with another without the need to fix them. Gathering the scattered pieces of ourselves. Not only does purity ask us to subtract the illusions we impose on the moment, it also asks us to gather ourselves together so that our whole self shows up to the moment. What does this mean? Yogi Raja Achala uses the phrase, be unalloyed. Alice Christensen speaks of being unfragmented. Whatever term we use, purity asks that all of us be in one place at one time. And that means that our head and heart are unified. Our thoughts, actions, and speech are congruent, and we are in the present moment. One of my friends related an incident with her 3-year-old son. It was a particularly busy day, and she was attending to many different things. In the process of all her busyness, her son was trying to get her attention. Frustrated, he grabbed her face between his hands and said, "You're not recognizing me." As this little 3-year-old reminded his mother, each moment, each person, each event asks us to recognize it by truly being present to it as it is. Like my friend in the story before, we often enter an experience with the clutter of scattered thoughts and leave the experience with even more cluttered thoughts. It is like we are living on the leftovers of where we have been, or the preparations of where we are going. Because we have not taken the time to catch up with ourselves, we are everywhere but the present moment. We are missing out on the fullness of life lived in the richness of what is immediately before us. Instead of entering the moment relaxed and spacious, we arrive frazzled and late because we try to do one more thing before we left. And often we leave messy and cluttered, already rushing off mentally to our next thing instead of breathing in a sweet closure to the moment. The practice of purity asks us to slow down and do one thing at a time. Purity embodies the slow steadiness and integrity necessary to give all of our attention to one thing at a time. As we practice slowing down and giving each thing our undivided attention, we will find ourselves more integrated and more pure with the moment. Hurrying, multitasking, and busyness, all symbols of success in our culture, are killers of purity. I have had the experience of waking up to my morning prayers and meditation, only to find that in one line of a prayer, I have almost planned my entire upcoming day. I have also had the experience of looking lovingly into my granddaughter's eyes as she is about to speak, and then realizing a moment later that she has finished speaking and I have not heard a word she said. In both of these instances, the moment happened and I was not there. Purity requires all of our attention in the moment, so that we can go on to the next thing with our full awareness and energy. Krishnamurti writes of the freedom this kind of engagement brings when he says, "I enter fully into each experience, and I come out fully from each of them too. I put the whole of me into all I do, and out of all I do." Purity asks that we make full and honest contact with the moment, so there is nothing lost and no regrets. There is no residue. Several years ago, I studied the Lord's Prayer in its original Aramaic language with Neil Douglas Klotz. The line interpreted in English as, "And forgive us our trespasses as we forgive others," when spoken in Aramaic, has a spitting out quality, as if saying the line itself is a letting go. Douglas Klotz interpreted this spitting out quality of the words as a literal act of forgetting what you know about the other person. It is as if you meet each person with a clean slate, not remembering any secrets they may have shared with you. The hidden hope is that each time you see this person, you can see them and relate to them in a pure manner. I often remember this line and notice that the secrets I know about others are mere clutter in my mind that keep me from the practice of purity. I continue to pray this petition of forgetting. The practice of saucha, or purity, of cleansing ourselves and cleansing our ability to be with each moment, takes on a visceral quality. As we begin to lose the heaviness of waste and clutter, we begin to feel lighter, more spacious and expansive. Our bodies become more alive, our minds become more clear, our hearts more compassionate. Questions for exploration. Living with these questions, taking time for reflection and journaling will give you new insights into your life and the practice of purity. For this month, frame your exploration in the following statement by Krishnamurti. "I enter fully into each experience, and I come out fully from each of them too. I put the whole of me into all I do, and out of all I do." Week 1. This week, notice where your body is sluggish. Begin to purify yourself through diet and exercise, and the space around you if that is making you sluggish. Notice how the sluggishness becomes lighter as you purify. Notice the difference between the external process of cleansing and the internal process of purifying. Week 2. This week, begin to purify your thoughts and speech. Use friends, ritual, forgiveness, journaling, etc., to release toxic, stale negative thoughts. Replace these thoughts with love and gratitude. Week 3. This week, be purely with yourself. In the words of Anthony DeMello, leave yourself alone. Journal the experience and what gets invoked for you. Week 4. This week, set aside one undisturbed hour where you take the entire time to eat one orange. Give this orange, and the delight of eating it, your full attention for the whole hour. For the rest of the week, slow down and be purely with each moment as it presents itself. Journal your experience. For this month, ponder the words of Krishnamurti and live purely with each moment as it is. Santosha. Stay in the center and notice each moment with calm serenity. CL. Santosha. Contentment. My husband and I own the 3 seasons of the TV series Kung Fu on DVD. We enjoy watching these episodes and pretending that, like Cain, we are masters of life. That no matter what happens, we remain calm and know exactly what to do. For those of you unfamiliar with the series, Cain, as a young orphan, entered a Chinese monastery and was trained in the martial arts and way of the Tao. He became a master in his own right and was initiated into a sect of the Buddhist priesthood. After an incident in which Cain was blamed for the death of the emperor's favorite nephew, Cain fled to America as a wanted man. It is in America that we watch Cain wander from town to town in complete mastery of his own life. Bounty hunters are continuously after him, yet he does not walk in fear. Instead, he meets each moment with curiosity and total presence. He has nothing, but he does not walk in lack. Instead, he meets each moment satisfied, able to see beauty and abundance. Where most people would find loneliness and deprivation, Cain finds contentment. And in his contentment, he is able to skillfully invite others into a deeper realization of their own ability to be strong of will and gentle of heart. Contrast this image of contentment with a sweet story my friend told me about her childhood. She remembers as a little girl of 6, standing on her front porch, gazing into the distance and thinking to herself, "Somewhere, people are having so much more fun than I am." Perhaps you, like I, can see the innocence of longing coming from this small child. And yet, as we grow through the years of our life, it is this continued longing that keeps contentment out of our grasp. In this country, advertisers magnify this longing in us, so that wanting what we don't have has become a contagious plague. Rather than experiencing contentment, we can find ourselves busy getting ready for the next thing, tossed about by our preferences for what we like and what we don't like, and riding the waves of annoying disturbances. The Jewel of Santosha invites us into contentment by taking refuge in a calm center, opening our hearts in gratitude for what we do have, and practicing the paradox of not seeking. Always getting ready. There is a Chinese proverb that states, "People in the West are always getting ready to live." There is a remarkable truth to this proverb. When we are little, we can't wait to get big. When we are big, we can't wait to get out of the house. Then we can't wait to get through college and get a job. Then we can't wait until our vacations. And finally, we can't wait until retirement. As the Chinese proverb states, we never really live. We just get ready. Along with getting ready for the next thing, we tend to look at other people's lives and see what is missing in our own. We look across the fence and see what we don't have, rather than look inside the fence and enjoy what we do have. When we look over the fence, we move ourselves into lack. A friend tells the story about how envious one of her sisters was of her during the time my friend led wilderness adventure trips. One day, the sister decided to go on one of these trips. On a particularly hard day, she found herself sitting miserably on the beach. A cold wind was blowing through her, and she was not feeling well from her monthly cycle. She looked at my friend and calmly said, "I'm not jealous of you anymore." When we expect the world to meet our needs, we turn outside of ourselves to find sustenance and completion. We expect our partners to fulfill us, our jobs to meet our needs, and success to solve all of our problems. And when it doesn't, we continue to play the if-only game, looking for that one more thing. Or we play the planning and regretting game. We let our contentment be managed by all these uncontrollable variables. As long as we think satisfaction comes from an external source, we can never be content. Looking outward for fulfillment will always disappoint us, and keep contentment one step out of reach. Pleasure and avoidance. We spend vast amounts of our lives moving towards what we like, whether the object is food, clothes, colors, music, self-image, conversation, hobbies, friends, activities, or beliefs. We see our preferences in all these areas as that which gives us pleasure, and we seek the permanence of that pleasure in our lives like it was a matter of life and death. Likewise, we move away from what we don't like. Anything that puts our pleasure at risk we see as repulsive and to be guarded against. We think we are free, but in truth, we spend huge amounts of our energy maneuvering ourselves and manipulating others so that our days will be filled with what we like and be void of what we don't like. I have noticed this maneuvering of life as a physical feeling of gripping in my body. When I find myself around something that gives me pleasure, it is almost like something in me grips with the desire for that pleasure. The same gripping sensation happens when I think I might miss out on the pleasure. Likewise, when I find myself in a meeting feeling bored or restless, I feel tenseness inside my body, as if I am trying to protect myself from the unpleasant experience. In truth, the yogis tell us, things are neutral. It is the personal labeling we put on these things that makes them appealing or repulsive to us. When I was a small child, I was made to sit at the kitchen table and finish eating my plate full of squash. It took me several miserable hours to complete the task, after which I swore to hate squash for the rest of my life. For decades, I carried on my hate campaign towards squash. It wasn't until very recently that I looked at squash in the store with more curiosity than hatred. I boldly bought the squash, brought it home, cooked it, and ate it. Much to my surprise, I loved the taste. The point is that the squash was neutral. It was my long history of giving meaning to the squash that made it at differing times both repulsive and pleasurable. Tsang Tsan poignantly stated, "The way isn't difficult for those who are unattached to their preferences." If you want to begin to experiment with the truth of this statement, try spending days doing what you don't like and not doing what you do like, and see how attached you are to your preferences. It is our need to satisfy our preferences that keeps us from contentment and makes our days difficult. Our seeking and avoiding, tensing and gripping, become expensive uses of our energy. Oscar Wilde once said that there are two kinds of unhappiness in the world. One is not getting what you want. The other is getting what you want. Perhaps he knew that satisfying our likes and avoiding our dislikes just keeps us on a roller coaster of needing to continue to satisfy our likes and avoid our dislikes. True freedom and contentment begin to find their way to us when we can see things as they are, neutral, and not spend so much energy manipulating things according to our preferences. I am reminded of the wisdom of a 116-year-old man who, when asked the secret to his longevity, replied, "When it rains, I let it." We are responsible for our own disturbances. Not only do we ride the waves of likes and dislikes, we also ride the waves of emotional disturbance. Think of how often you feel upset, hurt, left out, not appreciated, put upon, etc. It is easy to give the power of our emotional state to someone or something outside of ourselves. When we give away our emotional well-being to what others are saying or not saying, or to how the day is unfolding, we are at the mercy of things beyond our control. We have allowed our own contentment to be determined by what other people say or do. We have made ourselves helpless. Carlos Castaneda writes, "Think about it. What weakens us is feeling offended by the deeds and misdeeds of our fellow men. Our self-importance requires that we spend most of our lives offended by someone. Whether we react to this perceived offense with a verbal explosion, silence and withdrawal, confiding in someone else, or saving the offense until 6 months later when no one else remembers, emotional disturbance is an inappropriate and wasteful use of energy. It is a stance of powerlessness that guarantees contentment will always be out of reach. In my experience consulting with companies, private coaching with individuals, and in my own family life, it is clear to me that emotional disturbance takes a huge toll. It causes a loss in service to the client, unnecessarily sloppy work on the team, pain and misunderstanding in the family, and a toll on our own health and well-being. When we are hooked on our disturbances, we have tunnel vision, and we regress to the level of intelligence of the emotional disturbance. When we are not hooked, we have access to a panoramic vision. We can see all the angles. We can see a clear win-win, creative direction. As if outside events weren't enough to hook us into emotional disturbance, when things are quiet, we can tend to play and replay stories in our minds that are sure to cause us to be upset. Whether we are remembering what someone did to us 10 years ago or yesterday, the mind has an amazing ability to relive this disturbance over and over and over again, bringing us deeper and deeper into discontent. There is a Japanese proverb that states, "The noise does not disturb you. You disturb the noise." I admit, as a lover of silence, I had to think about this for a long time. I have always viewed loud noises as disturbances of my calm, peaceful nature. What this proverb so brilliantly taught me is the reality that, when I am upset by noise, I am the one who is disturbing the flow of life, not the noise. There is no escape. We can always trace our emotional disturbances back to ourselves. We keep ourselves out of contentment. Much like emotional disturbances can easily hook us, the glitter and promises of the outside world also demand our attention. I especially noticed the stimulation of technology when I returned from a month's sabbatical in the woods. I wrote the following as I watched myself slowly move from a place of contentment to the captivating buzz of stimulation. Ringing. That's what it was. On sabbatical, I never heard any ringing. No ringing of the doorbell announcing someone wanted to see me. No ringing of the telephone creating a duet with the programmed ringing of my cell phone, often making a trio of sounds as my computer would chime in, "Mail truck," announcing at least one new email has arrived, making a total of at least 3 people who were trying to contact me at the same time. Nor was there the ringing of my alarm clock, telling me it was time to start the day or get up from a nap. Now that I am home, I am witness to the cacophony of rings. Unlike the sounds of nature, where I could sit in pure delight, being drawn more and more inward in contemplation, these rings are impatient taskmasters, jolting me from my present state and demanding an immediate response. Notice me now. Answer me now. Attend to me now. Whatever I was peacefully doing is now forgotten. My attention now shifted to the ring. And I notice that my responses range anywhere from total annoyance to the excitement of an unknown Christmas package. Who is on the phone? Who just emailed me? Now what does someone else want from me? The stimulation and demands are constant, and I begin to wonder, who is running the show here? If I'm not careful, I become a yo-yo to my responses of the various ringing sounds, a willing slave to drop whatever I am doing to respond to the ring. I am being trained to need stimulation and let a ring call me from my contentment. I am becoming one of Pavlov's dogs. Gratitude. It is not easy in this culture to stay contented. So how do we get there and how do we stay there? I can spin out of contentment so quickly that I am caught off guard with the surprise of it all. I watched myself one particular morning and learned once again the need for gratitude as a tool to keep myself centered in contentment. I was visiting a friend and was suddenly overcome with the beauty and location of her home. The rumblings of discontent had begun. I hadn't traveled this pathway for quite some time, but now on it, I watched with amazement at how fast the terrain became steeper and steeper, until I was at a dead run, tumbling down into the land of discontentment. Nothing was right with my life. Nothing was right with me. My morning began with meditation and a lovely visit to a friend's beautiful home. How did I end up here, bruised and disgruntled with the whole of my life? And how did I get here so quickly? One brief moment, a twinge of jealousy for someone else's home, and within an hour,